From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on December 27th in Rochester. A woman named Lynn Lubecki went out with her sister and met up with some friends. And she felt great. She had a wonderful time that night. Her sister was visiting from out of town. Lynn went home around midnight, and within half an hour, she felt like something was wrong. Despite her discomfort, she made it through the night, hoping to wake up feeling better the next day. And she didn't. Her symptoms got worse, and eventually Lynn could not stop shaking violently. She was taken to urgent care at 3:30 in the afternoon. That's where a nurse and doctor quickly recognized what was happening. Lynn was showing the signs of sepsis. They transported her by ambulance to Highland Hospital. At this point, Lynn says her memory kind of is hazier, but she recalls meeting an ER director and being told she would go into sepsis protocol. If she was nervous, she might have been calmed by the fact that this is a hospital that has won awards for how it prepares for sepsis cases. And today, Lynn considers herself one of the lucky ones. She says she is alive because of this particular series of events that happened in this city, at this particular hospital, with the professionals who were ready to diagnose her. Lynn was out of work for the month of January, essentially, but she's decided that the community needs to learn more about sepsis. So this hour, we welcome her to talk about what was no doubt the most frightening day of her life and the lessons she hopes we all can learn from it. And she's been here before. We know you through your work. Lynn's the Early Care and Education Strategy Director at the Children's Institute. Lynn Lubecki, welcome back, and I am sorry you went through this, but I'm really glad you're here. How are you?
Thanks, Evan. I'm doing better. I'm doing better. Still recovering, which I'm surprised about. But sepsis is not something I had heard of or was familiar with, and I'm just so grateful to the people in this community that do this work and that my life was saved by people doing their everyday job.
Well, we have a whole story to work through here, and frankly, I know it can be uncomfortable, but I'm glad you're here to tell it. I think it really, really matters. Dr. Timothy Lum is the chief of the emergency department at Highland Hospital and was the doctor who treated Lynn in the ER that day. Dr. Lum, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Evan.
And also with us is Diane Martin, registered nurse and a nurse educator at Highland Hospital's intensive care unit. Welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
So December 27th, your sister's in town from out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Any normal night, huh?
It was really wonderful to have my sister, her husband, my two nephews, my two children. We had a house full of people. And so my sister and I went to meet some old friends. We went out, had dinner, had drinks, fun time, you know. And then we came back home, and I got everybody settled where they had to go. And so people crashed in the house and went to sleep. And I had it in my head. I remember the last thought I remember having was to not disturb anyone. And that's important because the rest of the night, about a half an hour after everybody was settled, I started to feel very odd. I tried to go to bed, and I wasn't comfortable. I was in pain. Probably part of that was the kidney stone acting up, but it was also, which is what we'll talk about in a minute, but I couldn't complete my thoughts. And I went into a back room that's kind of separated from the house and tried to lay down, struggled with laying down. And I had a series of crazy things happen through the night. I had fallen. I was going back and forth to a bathroom, quietly throwing up. I had to go to the bathroom a lot. And I went back upstairs to try to sleep and then quietly went back downstairs and didn't say anything to anyone.
What did you think was happening?
I had, the first time I went upstairs, I just said, I think something's wrong. Maybe I'm having an appendix attack. And that is the last conscious thought I have. And
oh,
I don't know
gosh.
What happened. And all I thought is, this is going to get better. This will be better. Maybe I ate something. And it was just this strange thing. And then by the time morning came, I had gone upstairs three times to try to settle, removed myself and isolated myself into a room. And then when everyone started getting up, I went upstairs and tried to rest, and I couldn't. So I was up and down from the upstairs to the downstairs, engaging with my family, who didn't, they knew something was wrong.
Are you trying to sort of pass it off as normal as possible?
I probably. That's my MO. That's what I do.
It's kind of what
because
we do when we're all sick, right? I mean, we think like, well, I'll be fine. Don't
right.
worry about me, right?
I have all these people in the house. I want to try to keep things rolling. But I something was so wrong, and I couldn't even help myself by saying, I'm going somewhere, somebody help me. I just continued on that way for a while until the final time I went upstairs and then downstairs to try to reengage with people. And And then I started to shake, and I refused to go to the hospital because I was too cold. Mm. And they're looking like something's funny here. So we went to the urgent care at around 3:30 in the afternoon. And when we went there, while we were waiting, I had to run out of the urgent care, and I was throwing up in the parking lot. I was just running to corners right on Monroe Avenue. It was really scary. And then they took me in, and my memory is that I was being guided to the bathroom, and I missed the door, and so I was in full confusion. I didn't know. I couldn't take in the information, and I couldn't give any information. And so fortunately, I was with someone who could. You know, my partner helped. But it was terrible. And the nurse, when she took some vitals, mm-hmm. recognized that something was off. My blood pressure and my heart rate, there was something there that, and when she went to get the doctor, and when the doctor came in, the next thing I remember is being in the ambulance, mm-hmm. and then going into the emergency department at Highland Hospital.
Do you now have much recollection of what was happening when you hit the ED?
I have pieces. Of course, you think you have all the information, and as I've been talking to the people who were there with me, I'm missing pieces. I must have been in and out. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing the doctor's faces. I remember being very attended to. You know, and I kept saying things like, what am I, in a spa? Because I was very attended to. I was not forgotten, not for a minute, right? Mm-hmm. I had people, the nurses were talking with me, and they made me very comfortable, and I was being watched a lot. And I kind of remember where I was. And then when I entered the ICU, there was talk about getting surgery, because they identified quickly, and I don't remember exactly when, that the problem was coming from my kidney. I had later we found out an 8-millimeter kidney, which had...
Kidney stone,
thank you, that had blocked my ureter, mm-hmm. and it had been blocked for a while, and that's where the source of the mm-hmm. sepsis was. And so there was a urologist that had to come and take care of the infection before the kidney stone was taken out, which happened in January.
And so do you then have much recollection of waking up feeling better at any point or different? Because sometimes this happens where people go through a lot and then their next recollection is, I'm out of surgery or I'm out of some sort of medical event. What's your next real sort of strong memory of what happened?
So it was really interesting. I was very cognizant of my trip to the emergency department, and then eventually going into the operating room. I was very aware of that. I was talking with the anesthesiologist, who was very funny, and he was showing me pictures of his children. I can remember having this conversation. He was funny. And so we were having an engagement. He was making me very calm, and I had noticed that I wasn't hazy going down to the operating room, and so I had asked questions. How come I'm still aware of this? What's going on? I remember being in the operating room, and I can tell you the people who were in there. And when all of that was finished and I ended up in the ICU, I felt horrible. I didn't feel better. I felt confused, and my thoughts weren't connecting. I'll say this, but it's like I couldn't see, I couldn't read, I couldn't focus. I was aware of what was happening to me, and I was well taken care of, but I remember feeling a strange feeling all over my body. I'm used to being in control. I'm used to fighting. You know, I've been through other medical experiences where you just start fighting, and there was none of that. I felt I couldn't eat, and I wasn't allowed to eat. So I was very, very thirsty, so I got some ice, a lot of ice, for days, I think.
But at any point did you think, I could die here?
It's funny you say that, Evan, because there was one point where, as I was laying there in the ICU, I believe, I thought to myself, okay, I can give in now.
Ooh,
and
wow.
I have never thought that. Ooh. I thought, I can't fight this. This is enough. And that was frightening.
So why don't I hand it over to Dr. Tim Lum, who you saw Lynn that day.
Yes.
And how did she present to you? What's going through your mind?
So in some respects, Lynn made it a little bit easy for me. in terms of presenting as sepsis. When she arrived, a very astute triage nurse in the emergency department called me and said, I've got a woman who just came in by ambulance and she looks sick. And when we say in the emergency department someone means sick, that's kind of our way of saying you're really sick.
Serious.
Right. Come on. And I recall meeting Lynn up at triage, still on the ambulance gurney, and recognizing by virtue of vital signs and just the general appearance, sometimes our gestalt matters here, mm-hmm. that this woman is sick. Her heart rate's elevated. Her blood pressure's down. Those are two specific vital signs that are often we find in sepsis, if not severe sepsis. And she had a fever, and she had chills by description. So we knew that we needed to get her back to her room immediately and essentially proceed to treat this as sepsis. So I believe I saw her essentially within a minute of arrival, and then spent a considerable amount of the next, you know, X part of an hour, you know, trying to help her out.
Now, by some measures here, this is the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer, and many of us, me included, wouldn't have been able to really even define it. 258,000 deaths per year. Mm-hmm. Now, again, we'll talk about, it's a little more complicated because it often comes at the tail end of other ailments, but still understanding that, what is sepsis? Let's start there.
So I like to keep it simple that sepsis is a potentially life-threatening condition that is part of the body's response to an infection. Mm-hmm. So it starts with an infection, and in the course of your body trying, in your immune system trying to combat the infection, there's a lot of chemicals released that are trying to help with grapple with the infection that can cause some issues really at the cellular level. And in a sense, the response of your body to trying to treat the infection can really get out of balance and cause some damage to entire organ systems, to the kidneys, the brain, the central nervous system. And the consequences of this are often that we start seeing low blood pressure, elevated heart rate, maybe decreased urine output. All of those are concerning signs for a patient who's getting very sick. And they warrant aggressive early intervention with two measures in particular, which is intravenous fluid and broad spectrum antibiotics. But the key really is recognizing mm-hmm. that this is what's in front of us. And it's not always that easy. I think in Lynn's case, in some respects, her body made it a little bit easier for us. Mm-hmm. This wasn't mimicking something else in my mind. You know, confusion, a patient comes in confused. We see that in the emergency department many times a day. And we have to think about other entities besides just sepsis. Could it be a stroke? Could it be a problem with their electrolytes or a low sodium level?
Well, how often do you see sepsis?
Every day.
Yes. Every day.
Every day.
And if it's untreated, how often is sepsis fatal?
Well, that's a little bit of a tricky question. I may have mm-hmm. Diane take a stab at that only because sepsis, I like to think that as part of a continuum or spectrum. It's mm-hmm. there's sepsis, there's severe sepsis, there's septic shock. Mm-hmm. You know, it really depends how quickly we intervene.
What did Lynn have?
She was severe sepsis, if not yes. septic shock.
I'd
ultimately.
Have to look at her chart because after yeah. the fluids, we'd
at
need
at the
to
very
see.
Least she was severe sepsis mm-hmm. and probably right on the border of septic shock, which is really the most serious scenario. I would have to look to see how low her blood pressure is, but mm-hmm. I will say this: that it we were treating her as septic shock very aggressively.
I guess mm-hmm. what I'm asking, before I turn to Diane mm-hmm. here, is if someone has sepsis mm-hmm. and not severe sepsis or septic shock, mm-hmm. and there is no medical attention, does it always progress in that direction? Does it clear itself up in any sort of natural function?
It could. It's hard to know kind of the denominator. You know, a young, healthy person, you know, who may have pneumonia may never even come to the hospital, and they may go to their primary care and get some antibiotics. And while technically they may have met some of the criteria for sepsis, it's possible in an outpatient setting with a healthy immune system and some oral antibiotics, they may have never progressed. So it's kind of hard to get to the bottom of that. But I will say, if you come to the hospital and we diagnose you as septic, the whole point is we're trying to intervene before we get to that next step.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the tricky part.
So yeah. Diane, If someone comes in and you have to tell someone you have heart disease, they know what that is. You have cancer, they know what that is. If you say you have sepsis, what percentage of patients know what that is?
Oh, very few. Very few. Yeah. I mean,
one in five? One in 10, maybe?
At least one in 10 or worse.
Wow.
Yes. Not many people know what that means. And it's part of our job, I think. And we've gotten better over the years, but we have tons of room for growth. Is we need to teach people and start using the word. Some people get discharged after a sepsis admission, and they say, wow, I had a wicked infection, or, you know, yes, I was hospitalized last month with a bad infection, and no one ever told them the word sepsis. So sometimes it's important to use the words, and we need to.
So if you see it every day, do you see it in the state that Lynn had every day?
Yes.
You do?
So... We do keep track, and every hospital in New York State has to keep track now. Since 2014, a regulation came about where we have had to track our cases, and every hospital in New York State has to, and we were the first state in the country, but now other states have followed suit. So we know our numbers quite well. And at Highland last year, we had maybe 850 or so people in that condition over a year.
So in a moment, we'll turn back, Diane, and talk symptoms here. But did you know what sepsis was?
I hadn't the slightest idea.
Did anyone in your circle of family, friends know what it was?
No. And even after I went through the experience, the common question was, did you catch that in the hospital?
Oh.
That was just an infection you might have picked up.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew.
Okay. How long were you hospitalized?
A week. I was in 7 days.
And... going from that really harrowing moment where you're almost feeling your body giving up, how long did it take before you can recall feeling like, I feel kind of decent, like I'm gonna be good?
A lot longer than I thought I would. So I had gone home after the 7 days. There were a lot of things they were watching. What I liked about the care I received at Highland was that it was very individualized. The people around me, once I started to be able to stand up, and they really allowed me to be a little independent, so I would be able to make my own bed, things that made me feel normal. That was important for me. And then when I went home, I remember at the hospital eating cream of wheat, and I was so happy. I'd never eaten something so delicious in my life, right? Little things that I appreciate.
Oh, I hear you.
So when I went home, every little thing I did made me exhausted. If I had to go to the bathroom, I was exhausted. If I ate lunch, I had to take a nap. And I'm not accustomed to that feeling. So it took me almost 4 solid weeks to feel as if I was, I could function. I was sleeping 18 hours a day after the hospital. When I came home, 18 hours, and it went down to 14 hours a day. And once I got to a good 11 hours, I started to feel more normal. And once I could start cleaning out every room in my house, slowly, but I did it, then I was ready to go back to work. And when I went back to work, because mentally I needed to go back into a routine, I was so tired. I went to work for the first day, went home and was sleeping by 7 o'clock. So, and I'm still feeling fatigue after this. It's kind of not a tired like I was, but not back to normal. My energy
levels. How long have they told you to expect these kind of symptoms?
Well, my primary care doctor really was just telling me to listen to my body. That's the only thing I'm getting from him. So that he's like, you need to listen to your body. Don't barrel through this like you did before.
Mm-hmm.
I had breast cancer, I think. I mentioned that, and so he's like, you need to listen to your body. Your body's not going to respond well if you push it. So when I went to the CDC website, I had learned that there's something called a post-sepsis experience, where your body can experience depression or sadness, or there's actually something called a there's a PTSD kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Mm-hmm.
So I read up on that, and this could go on for a year. It could go on for a while. I'm just being more mindful of my how I feel.
Sure.
And responding to it.
Diane, was she hour by hour? I mean, her life was on the line, you think, that day?
I would have to look at her chart, but it sounds to me like she was really sick. you know, the 850 people I mentioned weren't all at the extreme where Lynn was. You know, 850 people may have met criteria, but it sounds to me like her blood pressure was low enough that we had
it was dangerous
significant concerns. Yeah.
Yeah. You agree with that, Doctor?
Absolutely. I did cheat and glance at your chart. And although I do remember you that day, but there were a couple blood tests that suggested how mm-hmm. sick you were. One is something called a lactate, which is very elevated, and that's a blood test we use in when we are looking at sepsis, and it's really a measure of we call perfusion and how poorly your body is perfusing its major organs with blood because your blood pressure is low. And it can correlate with mortality and morbidity. And your number was 7.6. So to put that in context, we think of over 2 as a problem. Certainly over 4, a much bigger problem. But 7.6 is this number that will get any emergency medicine or ICU doctor's attention in a big way. There was another blood test that has to do with your white blood cell count. The white blood cell count in sepsis tends to run high, but it can also run low. But you had a specific subcomponent of your white blood cell count called the bands, B-A-N-D-S, bands, which are immature white blood cells. If we start seeing those circulating in the bloodstream, that's also very concerning. We'll say up to maybe 5% is okay, but you were 19%. Mm-hmm. And you put that together with the overall picture that elevated lactate of 7.6, and that's a very sick patient. And yeah, you are mm-hmm. you're critical.
Yep.
And again, the early intervention with the antibiotics and fluids based on your weight, et cetera, mm-hmm. that's really the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Are you, Lynn, the type of person now who is, you know, is everything more meaningful to you now, having been? I'm trying to be trite here, but mm-hmm. you know, you could have died that day.
Yeah.
Has that changed you in any way?
So I've had experiences like this over my life. I've always been somebody very grateful for the breath, very grateful for life. This, I think this experience has really done something to how I'm feeling, right? I'm feeling a lot of emotions. Every moment it comes into my mind, I could have missed it. I have a new grandchild. Mm. He's 7 months old. And my children, looking at them, right? The papers. I'm like, did I get that will updated? Right? Crazy things. And even simple things like the interactions with the people I love. I mean, it's something to have this. Even if it's not conscious, it's within me. So it, as I was reflecting to even come here and to write that email, I thought to myself, what good could come of this, right? What can I do to influence some change in our community or do something better?
Is that why you emailed us?
Yeah. Yep. And it was funny because I've been in situations where I've interacted with a lot of medical professionals for my experiences with my mother, with my sister, with myself, and my brother. And this is the first time I've ever heard medical professionals say something like, whoa, wow. And they were careful with me, but they were very clear that this was a serious situation mm-hmm. I was in. The nurses, the doctors, I could see it in their eyes if I couldn't hear the words. And that's what made me understand how serious this was.
I want the professionals at the table to know how much she has just been extolling your virtues.
Oh, well, it's very kind.
That's great.
And this is a community I know that you feel should be pretty grateful mm-hmm. that we have the resources we have.
Yes.
Because you are not alone mm-hmm. and having gone through this.
Right.
That's another thing that you wrote in that email, that you think you're alive because this happened here.
Right.
And you're able to go to this particular place mm-hmm. with these professionals who had this training and this expertise.
Sure. Yeah.
Highland has been working really hard over the years to hone in and get better every day at this skill, and it's so wonderful to see and to hear you extol this. And we do want to increase community awareness of sepsis mm-hmm. so that people can understand it and act accordingly if they feel like it's if this is not a typical infection that you have.
Mm-hmm. Well, so why don't we do this? We have some listener questions, and I should mention, so Carolyn we're going to get your phone call after our only break of the hour. We've got a question from a listener. I have some emails we can read. And listeners, if you've got questions about sepsis, this is one heck of an education this hour for, frankly, for all of us. I mean, certainly for me, probably for you. As you heard Diane mention, most people don't know very much about sepsis at all, and it kills more than 250,000 people a year in this country. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Lynn Lubecki is an Early Care and Education Strategies Director at the Children's Institute, telling her remarkable story. She's doing well, and thanks in large part to people like Diane Martin and Dr. Timothy Lum who are here. Diane's a registered nurse and nurse educator at Highland Hospital's intensive care unit. Dr. Lum is chief of the emergency department at Highland Hospital. Let's go ahead and get that break, and we'll get your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Britton Bradford is a local artist and a talented basketball player. And growing up as an African-American child, he thought his only options for success in Rochester would be to become a rap star or a pro basketball player. Now he's a successful artist, but we're going to have a conversation about the paths that kids see to success. In our second hour, Dr. Luis Quiñones joins us, a scholar talking about the struggle for bilingual education. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking sepsis. Caroline in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Caroline.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing this program.
Sure.
I too had sepsis without knowing it. I thought I had the flu, ached, tired all the time, you know, until I ended up in the emergency room. They told me I was basically 24 hours away from my organs shutting down. And since then, I've gotten it again. So the doctor said, if you ever start to feel like this again, you know, get to the emergency room or get to your doctor. Are you more susceptible once you've had it to getting it again?
Yes. People who have had sepsis before do have a tendency to be a little bit more likely than the next guy to get it again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, some folks will be predisposed to it, and it depends certainly, Caroline, on anybody's particular medical conditions, if indeed they have any. But it can be a function of age, and if there's some coexisting medical conditions, respiratory diseases like emphysema or problems such as diabetes, that are going to really, I suppose, lower the threshold and for which you might, you know, become septic again.
Mm-hmm. But you'll be in a great position, though, having been through it before, is chances are you will yourself will recognize it earlier.
Sure.
And that
is
the key.
I recognize it right away.
Yep, perfect.
It was in the middle of the summer when that first time happened, and I just thought I had the flu. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought I had arthritis. I went through the whole gamut of, like, what could this possibly be, never knowing what sepsis was and what it could do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now that I know what it is, I know what to recognize and, you know, do something about it. So, mm-hmm. So thank you for doing this, because, like you said, no one knew when I told people what I had. They're like, well, what's that?
Yeah.
Like, well, tell you what that is.
Yeah, exactly.
Caroline, yeah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the phone call. And so her question brings up one of the more commonly asked questions, just in sort of poking around the corners of the internet trying to learn about sepsis as I was before this program, which is who can get it or who's more likely to get it. Diane?
Mm. It would be anyone who is more susceptible to that infection. So possibly the very old, the very young, and possibly somebody with multiple conditions may be a little bit more likely than the next guy. Truly, in fact, anyone who has an infection can go to that next step, but most infections will turn around. I don't want people to think, oh my gosh, the next time I get an infection.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want you to think like that. I just want you to know that there is another step. And anyone who is more likely to get an infection, you know, you're careful around, you know, older people or anyone who is vulnerable.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've seen, I'm sure, from, you know, the age of, you know, a neonate to, mm-hmm. you know, somebody in their 90s or early 100s, I've seen everybody with sepsis at some point.
Yes.
And you'd be surprised, young, healthy 25-year-old who comes with a cough mm-hmm. and pneumonia who can get extraordinarily ill. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean every 25-year-old with pneumonia gets it, but sometimes our body will betray us.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that. But the folks who are certainly at a more higher risk are those who have maybe some kind of baseline immunocompromised system, whether it's by medication or whatever their ailment may be, or again, as I alluded to before, they have diabetes or emphysema. They're in a kind of another a risk category.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Caroline mentioned that some symptoms present as similar to the flu, though we're always careful to distinguish here because flu is a term that becomes a catch-all for a lot of things.
That's right.
Wow. There's influenza. There's just a common winter infection that people call the flu. There's the man flu, you know.
Oh, that's
men
a
in particular.
Whole different thing. Sorry.
That's a medical term, isn't it?
It is. It is. I just I saw it in Wikipedia.
But when it comes to flu, a lot of people say, you know, this seems like the flu. So just real briefly, because we're talking a lot about viruses, we're talking a lot about what's contagious. Real quick, what are the symptoms of actual influenza?
So real influenza is almost always characterized by some upper respiratory symptoms, cough, dry cough, harsh cough, productive cough, almost always by fever, but not necessarily, usually by fatigue, extreme fatigue, mm-hmm. diffuse muscle aches. And I will say, I use it in very layman's terms with a patient. I said, did it come on suddenly? Do you feel like a truck ran you over?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, depending on the patient, you can say, do you feel like you're going to die? Because they'll say, yes, yes, and yes. That's what mm-hmm. I feel like. Out of the blue, truck ran me over, body aches, fatigue,
it's
cough.
It's not a buildup of symptoms. It happens pretty fast.
It comes on pretty darn quick. And it's got to be in the right season. And there's the epidemiology kind of the season, mm-hmm. which suggests this is right now we're smack in the middle of flu season.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is when you brought up Lynn's case of sepsis, you said you were aided as the director of the ED at Highland with her case by it was pretty clear. It didn't look like it was masking anything else. I mean, it looked to you like sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
Can sepsis present in different ways that become harder to diagnose?
That absolutely. So the art and the science of medicine kind of collide here, if you will, or align perhaps. So not everyone presents with a fever. Sometimes it's someone's going to come in with, perhaps they have a cough. Okay, well, maybe that may get us down a pathway thinking they have pneumonia. But maybe it's a cough, but the symptoms and signs we start thinking about is, are they confused? So altered mental status and that cough is going to get me start thinking about, maybe this is more than just pneumonia or bronchitis or the flu. You're seeing other collateral signs mm-hmm. Beyond just that cough. So the altered mental status, their skin may look, might look mottled, purplish, or just really pale or cool to touch or hot to touch. You may get some more information from the patient or the family that, geez, they haven't been urinating for the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of other kind of clues and simple things like the heart rate's elevated, the blood pressure's low. Though you start putting all that together, and you're going to start to entertain sepsis.
Not contagious. Sepsis is not contagious.
You're correct, because it just begins with an infection. Okay. Any germ can cause an infection, and any infection can cause sepsis.
Can sepsis be prevented?
Ha! I'm so glad you asked. Just the same way you prevent any infection. So everybody should be washing their hands, get vaccinations, do everything to prevent infections, what you know already. And if you are ill, try not to infect others. So don't go to work when you're sick. Don't go to public places. That's all normal stuff. And if you follow normal infection prevention, we could reduce the number of cases of sepsis.
Okay. So I think we've covered some of the basics. Any questions stand out to you when you look back saying, I wish I would have known? I mean, I don't know what you would have done differently, frankly, Lynn.
Well, you spend a lot of time thinking that way. I think this was brewing for a long time in my system, and I didn't recognize the signs. I had a backache. I had a lower back pain. I'm 54 years old. Mm-hmm. I have lower back pain. I sit in a computer all the time, mm-hmm. right? So there were certain things that if I look back, I could say, okay, maybe that was it. And I would have acted because, again, my kidney was sealed off, but I have another kidney, so I didn't recognize anything. One of the pieces that makes me that I wanted to point out was how I found out Diane Martin's name, and that was through her staff while I was in the hospital. Someone had said to me, one of the nurses had said, you really need to contact Diane because she's the person that trains all of the nurses here. So it was really nice to hear about the work she does getting people ready and about the work everybody does to get ready so that these series events could have happened.
It's 844-295-TALK, listeners, if you want to have join the conversation with questions or comments on sepsis. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Some emails to go through. Anne says, thank you for this topic. I'd like to know whether these practitioners or local hospitals have tried a new alternative vitamin C, B1 steroid, vitamin cocktail treatment. If so, what has their experience been? What does they see as the outlook? If not, why not? And so I don't know anything about this. Diane?
I have read about that, and I've been to a couple of conferences where it's been brought up. And when the vitamin C has been used in the articles that I read, it was used in combination with other things, and it is still being tested as an individual treatment as well as a combination therapy. But it isn't universally being shown as beneficial at this time, and so each component needs to be looked at. So some of the studies are very convincing, but no study is saying this is the way we must go.
Okay.
And certainly in the emergency department, that would not be, at this point, vitamin C or really any other kind of modality beyond what we're doing is that's not in our armament at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thanks for that. I sort of want to tread carefully when I make this remark, but there's a sizable community of people in the Rochester area, and they meet and they exchange films and I'm not at all saying you're part of this group, and I think everyone's intentions are good. People want to be healthy. They want their kids to be healthy. They want their communities to be healthy. But the group that I'm referring to has recently started sharing information saying that coronavirus could be cured with vitamin C infusion. If that were the case, I promise you it wouldn't be suppressed. The media wouldn't suppress that. The medical community would not suppress that. I promise you there's not a profit motive to suppressing good therapies.
I've been a nurse for 39 years now, and when I was a young nurse, HIV came around, was new to all of us, and we had a lot of learning to do. More recently, we've had Zika, we've been through SARS, now it's coronavirus. As I've seen new things come around, I just know that there's a learning curve, but some things have never gone away, like the basic infection prevention. Hand washing is still the number one and underestimated. It is the number one way we prevent infection. And we need to, the germs are microscopic. We can't see them. We have to picture that they're always here and not touch our faces and wash our hands and stay away from other people when we're not. So, yes, new modalities come around. I think I've been around long enough that I'm sticking with the old stuff until I see some evidence that
can be replicated.
Reproduced.
Trust.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And that's, it's great that we're all searching for that.
Oh, absolutely.
I guess all I'm saying to listeners, particularly the ones who've been engaging me all week about corona, is that I think it's okay to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to want evidence.
Yes.
But let's be careful. I'm not a doctor. Yes. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a researcher. And I'd be very careful about ascribing some sort of nefarious mm-hmm. motives. Nobody wants to see this coronavirus spread.
Yes.
Nobody wants to see it not contained.
Right.
And if there is a therapy for sepsis that is going to be mm-hmm. accessible, we're going to know about it. And that'll be great.
Yes. And sepsis,
that'll be great.
The therapy is antibiotics. And the timeline begins as soon as it's recognized, like mm-hmm. Dr. Lum and his staff immediately, as a matter of fact, the urgent care that Lynn went to, immediately getting them to Highland, and then Dr. Lum being right on it when she appeared. The timing of the first IV antibiotic into Lynn's bloodstream determined her mortality, because mortality does increase 8% every hour once you reach this point in sepsis. And that's what she benefited from, was early recognition and therapy that is evidence-based, and it got into her bloodstream immediately.
Wow. Let me grab Roy on the phone next. Go ahead, Roy.
I had an episode with it. Finally got to the hospital. and, you know, I'm slipping in and out of being coherent, and I just was shivering, you know, my teeth were chattering, and I'm shivering like crazy. Nurse walks out of the room and asks my partner, is he faking it? But in the end, I spent 12 days in the hospital, and they finally did figure it out.
Sounds difficult.
How are you doing now, Roy?
I'm staying out of the hospital, staying healthy, washing my hands a lot, and trying not to have another episode like that.
How long ago was that, Roy?
3 years ago.
Mm. Okay. Well, good luck to you. Thank you. I mean, obviously, I can't speculate about why someone may say certain things. It is my assumption, Diane, that mm-hmm. every year we're getting better at diagnosing, we're learning more.
Yes.
It'd be probably surprising to hear an incident like that today, no matter where it happened.
It would be surprising, but I can't speak to
sure.
to that individual situation. I'm sorry it happened, but certainly I can speak from our perspective at Highland Hospital, as we have been measuring and improving our care every year and feeling really good about it. But looking at all of the statistics from our own hospital and across the nation, we all have room to grow. We need to keep pushing, keep repeating, and this program and any community education is extremely important to just spread the word, get in early, and get the right therapy.
You want to add to that, Dr. Lum?
I think the recognition, both by, to the extent that a patient or a family can recognize it themselves, and sometimes that's a lot to ask. I don't want to put the onus on you, but certainly if you present to the hospital, that's our job. And I think, you know, certainly Diane's efforts through our Highland Hospital in terms of being a champion for sepsis and our work within our own department and across the hospital and being, I'm going to use the word aggressive again, but intervening early with the fluids and the antibiotics. And you know what? If we're wrong that you turned out not to be septic, it was something else, you know, we probably didn't cause any harm.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's a somewhat of a change. I will say that, you know, we do have a responsibility for the use of antibiotics. We call it antibiotic stewardship. And we want to be responsible and judicious in the use of antibiotics and how we use them. And I think we've loosened that a little bit in the sense of if we're too restrictive about the use of antibiotics, we may miss the opportunity to treat somebody with sepsis early. So I think we've liberalized our use of early aggressive antibiotics across our hospital, but across our other hospitals in our system, certainly, and I'm sure at the other hospitals in the community. But this is about recognition and having sepsis at the forefront mm-hmm. when a patient presents. Again, in the emergency department, we have to think about a spectrum of kind of entities that may be responsible for what someone's symptoms are, but that can mimic sepsis, as I referred to earlier. But we've gotten a lot better at it, and we'll mm-hmm. continue to keep our foot on the pedal.
And Lynn's story is great with urgent care, having caught it, our emergency department team right on it, our intensive care team right on it, and then even to the floors, because I'll say after a person leaves intensive care, some of the reason that America doesn't know what the word means is people don't use the word. So someone must have been talking to you about the word sepsis. And I think that's an important part of care. So I'm really pleased to see that from urgent care through ED, ICU, and the general wards, you were hearing the word and now we're spreading the word, I hope.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened.
Well, Lynn, your decision to tell your story publicly has opened the floodgates. I'll read some more email here. A lot of share. And by the way, Dave called in from Brockport. Just wanted to pass along. He had Tim Lum as a student at Aquinas. he was a great guy then and a great doctor now.
I know who this is. Did I say his name or not?
Go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Kleehammer.
Oh.
Or Mr. Klee. He was my science teacher.
Nice.
I think biology.
See? Everybody listens to connections. See? You can't escape. Jane writes to say, Evan, thanks for having this discussion. I think there are a lot of people who don't know about sepsis and just how serious it is and how many have been affected by it. I have a friend in the UK who has a traumatic and premature delivery of her son, and she almost died of sepsis. Mm-hmm. Back in November, I had an abdominal abscess, and 2 days after I saw my PCP for that, the pain was getting worse, and there was a lot of redness below that area. It was hot to the touch. I thought about waiting till the next day to go back to my PCP, but when I saw the angry red lashes in the bathroom, I knew it was infected, and I was worried that it was sepsis. I went to urgent care and was diagnosed with a case of cellulitis, and due to how fast it spread, I had to go on 2 strong antibiotics. Going to urgent care that night was the right move to make. I could have developed severe sepsis. I'm glad your guest made it through, and I hope she has a complete recovery. Mm-hmm. So there's the story. I mean, again, I'm reading terms I don't fully understand. Jane, thank you. I mean, Dr. Lum, does it sound like that progression, does that make sense to you there?
She said she thought she had an abscess or some cellulitis. And, you know, generally speaking, an abscess requires more than just antibiotics. We usually have to cut that open if it's relatively superficial and drain it in the emergency department. But they can be much deeper and require a trip to the operating room with a general surgeon to drain. It depends. But it sounds like this was addressed early as more of a superficial cellulitis, so infection of the skin, and they got on it with antibiotics, but it certainly can progress.
That's great. So let me read also from Jennifer. It says, 5.5 years ago, I had ARDS with sepsis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, bummer.
What's ARDS?
Adult respiratory distress syndrome.
Okay, with sepsis. Because of the pneumonia, I was placed in a medically induced coma for 10 days. The doctors at Unity were wonderful. Mm-hmm. They really didn't think I would live. They told my husband to call my family and bring my son back from college. I'm still here, obviously, and I'm not very happy to hear I'm more likely to get sepsis again. Again, Jennifer, an increased chance, but certainly not a certainty.
Right. And to tell you the truth, if you've learned it before, because chances are the first time it happened to you, you've never heard of it and didn't know what could happen if an infection takes that ugly turn, now you know what to look for. And literally, you will catch it much sooner. You'll be more informed. So chances are, if you're ever going to get it again, and I hope you don't, but you will probably catch it very early and may not even have to go to the hospital. You'll visit a doctor and turn it right around.
All right. Let me get John on the phone next. Go ahead, John.
Hi. This is John from Rochester. As Lynn's son, I just want to extend my gratitude for the care that she had. Hi, Mom.
Hi,
was,
John.
That was a really scary thing for us. And to, sort of recognize as she did that, we could be without her. Especially, in my early 30s, that put things in perspective for both myself and my sister. So,
I'm really proud of your mom, John.
Hang here for a second, John. I just want to say, Lynn, did you know that John was going to call?
I did not know. I didn't know. No.
You've got a couple of tears coming, John, from your mother, and I know she appreciates that. Does this put it into more perspective for you when you think about? I know you said that day you were confused. That was one of the symptoms that Dr. Lum talks about, confusion. But when you had finally a chance to kind of catch your breath and realize how close it was, and you're not just thinking about you, you're probably thinking about everybody.
Oh, yeah. And we've experienced some significant loss over our lifetime. My children have, losing their grandparents or losing their uncle. My brother was very young when he died. He was 36. And the impact of that loss, and especially my kids are 31 and 28, and that's young. To me, that's very young. And then we have this new little life in our lives, little baby Benny, you have to mention him. And looking around and looking at the my partner and my sister, and you just really look like that could have been it. Mm-hmm. And it resonated with me when New Year's weekend, because that would have been the day, right? And I think that adds to the sadness. Mm-hmm. There's this like sadness that happens. I think that's kind of the contributing factor, but you always need to be grateful for every day. We knew that always, and we continue to be grateful for every day. don't hold a grudge.
So I would love to take a little bit of what anyone has learned today and see if we can raise community awareness about sepsis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we do have the 5th annual Sepsis Challenge.
Hey, could you hold that thought for 1 second? I just want to let John go and say, hey, John, much love. Thanks for making the call. That's really beautiful and thoughtful of you, and I know Lynn feels it, and we're glad you called. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, everyone.
Love you, John.
Bye-bye.
Love you,
Mom.
So as we wrap here, go ahead, tell us about this.
Yes, so we do. There are people all over the community, myself and others. We have a small committee that have been running this sepsis event every year called the Sepsis Challenge. It's a 5K run or walk, and we can also do a 1K. This year, it's on Saturday, June 27th in Genesee Valley Park. If you're interested in joining us, we have survivors. We have people who just want to become more aware. So go to rochester.sepsischallenge.org and join us. And let's make this a big thing. Let's get the word out so we don't have to hear about it after the fact.
Saturday, June 27th. Lynn Lubecki, thank you so much for making this happen this hour. You know, you're telling your story, and a lot of people, I understand, personal stories like this are private. I know you wanted the community to hear it for a lot of reasons. I hope you see the feedback we've had. You've impacted a lot of people.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Thank you. And the next time we talk, let's talk about your work and some other things.
Got some good things in mind.
I know. I'm sure you do. That's Lynn Lubecki. Diane Martin, registered nurse and nurse educator at Highland Hospital's Intensive Care Unit. Thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you for having us.
You got it. And Dr. Lum, thanks for what you do for the community as well at Highland. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Got really, really great stuff. Really remarkable and important stuff this hour. David Griffin, thank you for volunteering. Emery Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.